We're talking the rest of this hour at the problems facing the world's amphibians and what scientists are trying to do about them. According to my next guest, about a third of the world's nearly 6,000 amphibians, and that's a class of animals that includes frogs and toads and salamanders and newts, nearly a third of these animals are at risk of becoming extinct. The decline in the numbers can be traced in part to habitat loss and commercial overexploitation, but many of these animals are dying because of a fungus that scientists have yet to fully understand. So what, if anything, can be done to help keep these animals from becoming extinct? Well, my next guest has an idea about that. Joseph Mendelson is a curator of herpetology at Zoo Atlanta. He's also acting executive officer of the Amphibian Specialist Group at the World Conservation Union. Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
And if you'd like to ask Dr. Mendelson a question about frogs and how to help preserve them, call us. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And, when did we notice this decline in frog population?
In 1989, scientists first began to realize, wait a minute, there seems to be something going on here. And then we spent all of the time after that trying to pinpoint exactly what was going on. And I think we came to a consensus in the last year.
And what was that?
The consensus from a very broad group of stakeholders at the Amphibian Conservation Summit held in D.C. Included about 200 delegates that essentially we all agreed amongst ourselves, which is difficult for academics, that amphibian declines and extinctions are real. The scope of the problem is large and global. And the enigmatic declines, the things that have been so mysterious to us all through the 90s, were suddenly becoming evident what was causing these. For example, the fungus you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, if you realize a problem of that scope is at hand, then a large-scale response in terms of research and conservation must be mounted.
All right. So obviously, if there are animals that have gone extinct, you're not going to get them back. But what can you do if there's a fungus that you can help the animals from becoming prey to?
Well, as we learn more about the fungus, we'll learn more about how to control it and treat it, et cetera. At this point, however, the best we can do is make a few predictions about when and where it's going to strike, and very few predictions at that front.
This is where I'm having problems with this whole question about controlling funguses. First of all, they're very hard to control under any circumstances. But second of all, can you see spreading fungicides all over the place in this country?
Those are the very difficult questions we have to face. Distributing fungicides across ecosystems would kill all the fungi in the ecosystem. That's probably worse than killing all the amphibians in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't seem possible. I think the answers are going to lie in trying to figure out how to help the amphibians become resistant become resistant to the fungus themselves in the wild. That's basic research that's going to take a considerable amount of time.
Well, okay. How much time do we have? I mean, is anybody saying the rate at which these frogs are disappearing?
Well, in the example of Panama, where we have some very good data about where the fungus is and where the fungus isn't, we're literally watching it move at about 28 kilometers a year down mountains and eliminating the vast majority of amphibians in its path. And so in that case, we made a prediction in 2005 that this one particular site called El Valle would become stricken in 2006. And as much as I hate to say it, all of our scientific predictions were absolutely correct, and the frogs are dying there as we speak. And those are the last populations of several of these species in the wild.
Has this become a problem in the United States yet?
The fungus is in the United States. It's well documented in states like Wyoming, Colorado, and California, and Oregon. And it's having it has differing effects in different places and with different species. This makes it very difficult to predict exactly what it's going to do. Sometimes it surprises us and the effect is not quite so bad. And sometimes the effect is absolutely devastating.
And I'm just trying to think now about a world without frogs. I mean, I don't want to be facetious about this, but is there really a good reason to say we would be worse off if we didn't have frogs?
Well, with respect to all amphibians, none of us have ever said or predict that we're going to lose all amphibians. Some species, for example, American bullfrogs, are apparently resistant to the fungus, and they're not going to go anywhere. But if you do take out amphibians from ecosystems at many places around the world, that can only have massive effects on ecosystem function. Not having done that experiment ourselves, it's very difficult to anticipate exactly what those effects will be, but they should be at large scale.
Now, you've called for the formation of the Amphibian Survival Alliance. What's that going to be, and how is it going to work?
Well, essentially, as I said, if we admit that we have a large-scale global problem, then we have to have a large-scale global response. And that's beyond the possibility of an independent research lab at this university or a group of conservationists at this NGO. We really need to work across disciplines and governments and organizations and come at this in a completely unified approach to give support where support is needed rather than people trying to support themselves. And that's the concept of the Amphibian Survival Alliance and working under the umbrella of the IUCN, the World Conservation Union, of course.
Mm-hmm. And is there a target amount that you're trying to raise?
We budgeted something in the neighborhood of $400 million for 5 years to get this jump started. And realizing if you're talking about the endangerment of an entire vertebrate class, $400 million, that's less than the price of two 747 airplanes.
All right.
And that will move us forward 5 years very aggressively to really implement programs at the scale that we think we need, both in research and conservation, on all fronts, not just the chytrid fungus, everything from habitat to environmental toxins to over-collecting in this case, and habitat protection.
Okay, let's take some calls now, and first we'll go to Gary in Mitchell, South Dakota. Gary, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm reading a book called The Weathermakers by an Australian scientist, and I'm sorry, the name escapes me at the moment. And he was speaking specifically to amphibian problems with this fungus. And he said that when the amphibians are, for instance, with frogs, tadpoles, that they're very sensitive to ultraviolet, and that it reduces somehow their resistance to this fungus. And because, he says, because of climate change, the ponds in which they're born are shallower, and therefore they're exposed to more ultraviolet, and therefore they're less resistant to the fungus. And he suggests that this is one of the major causes of the problem you're discussing. And I'm curious about your response to that, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Gary.
That question, the link between climate change and amphibian declines, is an important one. And a very nice paper came out by Alan Pounds et al. In Nature earlier this year that shows for the first time a pretty compelling link between climate change and the persistence and spread of the conditions that are perfect for this fungus. This fungus, as it turns out, is very restricted in its temperature regime. It dies at particularly high temperatures. And according to their models, in some areas, for example, Central America, where they worked, climate change produces situations that are perfect for the persistence and spread of this fungus. That is different than directly showing that climate change is killing the frogs themselves. That evidence is, we don't have that evidence, but we now have a link to climate change. With respect to ultraviolet radiation that you mentioned, the links between ultraviolet radiation and amphibian deaths are real in the fact that increased ultraviolet radiation will kill amphibians, but they have not been implicated in causing these multiple declines and extinctions we see around the world.
All right. Let's take another call from Mark in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The nature of my question has changed now that I've heard more of what you had to say.
Mm-hmm.
I live and work in the state of New Jersey where we have the highest amount of golf courses per capita in the world, practically. So the amount of active ingredient of pesticides that's applied and reported to the DEP is pretty massive in the state. Do you see any link or correlation between this fungus, say, taking off in a more rapid fashion in a place where there's a lot of excessive pesticide runoff in a state like this?
A variety of agricultural chemicals clearly do have very deleterious effects on amphibians. I'm sad to say that we still need a lot more research in that area. However, direct links between certain herbicides and the desexualization of frogs have come out, and those are very clear. So that's a direct influence that reduces their ability to reproduce. With respect to the fungus, There are some suggestions, in fact, that the that exposure to a variety of the type of chemicals that might be used on golf courses, for example, may increase their susceptibility to the fungus. And that, so that's a possibility, and it's a very good possibility, actually. But we don't have that simply requires more research.
Let's go now to Angela in Dutton, Alabama. Angela, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I, too, have noticed a large decrease in the amphibians. Grew up on a farm, was raised around water literally all my life. During the spring, late spring, early summer, you just had to watch where you walked to keep from stepping on the little bitty frogs, tiny ones. But lately, I have noticed the only tadpoles that are surviving are the bullfrog tadpoles. And I've also noticed about 25 to 30 years in time, the water supply has gone down. The ponds are spring fed, and it's like the water is just not there. And I'm wondering if this fungus actually thrives due to maybe the low water?
That's an interesting possibility. Dr. Mendelson, any thoughts about that?
Well, your observations are completely consistent with what we keep seeing around the world. I was on a creek in Panama last week where a year ago I could find 40 to 50 frogs in a night, and last week I spent 10 hours on that creek. We found one frog. So I can match your observations, quite sadly, at numerous places around the world from my own experience and other people's data sets. In other words, that's what we're all agreeing, that these declines and extinctions are real. We just don't quite understand why some species aren't disappearing, other species are disappearing, and while we now have made great progress on some of the causes, for example, chytrid fungi and environmental toxins, and of course habitat loss, we still stand to learn a lot about the interactions between those, between climate change and ecotoxins and water levels, as the guest pointed out.
We're talking with Joseph Mendelson. He's the curator of herpetology at Zoo Atlanta. And we're talking about what can be done about the declining population of amphibians in this globe that we live on. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And speaking of zoos, I'm just wondering, what role do zoos or can zoos play in restoring frog populations or amphibian populations?
Well, if you take the situation where you have an invading fungus that's predictable, and the fungus is going to move into an area at a time that in some cases we can predict, and you know what's going to happen, the direct elimination of most of the individuals and most of the species from that area, then in some cases we've resorted to the absolute last-ditch thing, which is go in and get them out of harm's way to literally, technically keep them from going extinct, while the necessary research moves forward to figure out how to really solve the problem. Those programs don't solve the problem, but they do buy the species some time. And so taking care of things in captivity, that's what zoos do the best.
All right, let's take another call from Mark in Warrington, Missouri. Mark, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
My question, I'm wondering, has anybody looked at the possibility that the amount of copper that is occurring in water supplies has declined over the decades, copper being a great natural fungicide, and since amphibians are, by their nature, constantly in contact with water, especially when they're, when they first hatch out, even tiny, tiny amounts of copper, would that have an impact? And I'm thinking of the notion that I've heard on NPR that us flushing down things like hormones that are excreted from our body that get into the water supply that may have caused mutations in amphibians. Could it be that lower amounts of copper are allowing fungus to kill off these amphibians?
Mark, thanks for that. What about that, Joseph Mendelson?
That's a great question, and I'll be honest, with the specific reference to link between copper and the fungus, I don't know the answer to that. I hope that my colleagues that work in environmental contamination are thinking about things like that, but I'll be honest, I don't have the answer for that.
Okay.
And,
Well, that's fine, but it's an interesting thing to kick around, I guess.
It sure is. I hope my colleagues are listening.
Well, I hope so, too. Let's take one more call from Catherine in Sacramento. Catherine, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
My specialty is in paleontology, and I'm just wondering from sort of an evolutionary perspective, amphibians have been around for hundreds of millions of years and have gone through multiple mass extinctions before and have survived. And I'm wondering if there's any perspective on what's different about this time around that's causing such decimation to them versus other mass extinctions that they've made it through.
That is the million-dollar question. The breakthrough that we've had is that we now all agree on several important things, like this is real. Realize for a long time it was arguable whether this was just a perception and a sampling error on our part. And so that is resolved, and some of the direct causes have now been identified. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, we realize we're witnessing a contemporary large-scale extinction event. From several perspectives, one, this is a really important and interesting research opportunity to learn what does a large-scale extinction event look like, and realize that with respect to disease, we have not considered previously that a single pathogen that we honestly didn't know existed until 6 years ago is capable of this type of elimination of individuals, of populations, and of species across broad taxonomic and geographic scales. Could something like this have happened before? Possibly. May it happen again? Possibly. But we know it is happening now, and we can learn a lot about it, and I think we should do so. A colleague of mine put it nicely in a paper one time. He said, the amphibians are sending us a message, and that is really that the world is changing, and when the world changes, large-scale extinction events can happen, and I think we're watching one now.
Well, that's a cheerful note to end on, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have. I'd like to thank Joseph Mendelson. He's the curator of herpetology at Zoo Atlanta, and he's also acting executive officer of the Amphibian Specialist Group at the World Conservation Union. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Vahan Baladuni. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. You can send us an email. Our address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.